This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue. I'm Bill McCush. On the show this week, a North Sydney woman talks about her sister and civil rights pioneer Viola Desmond. The RCMP weighs in with their pet peeves on bad winter driving habits. And speaking of pets, the Department of Natural Resources says you may want to keep an extra eye on your dogs and cats because coyotes are stepping it up on the hunt for food and a mate. This is Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. Viola Desmond is a familiar face for just about everyone in Canada who's ever held a $10 bill. On one side of the bill, there's a picture of the Queen. On the other side, it's Viola. That's just one of the ways officials have recognized her as a civil rights pioneer because of her act of defiance at a movie theater on the mainland 75 years ago. Here's Viola's younger sister, Wanda Robson, from North Sydney.
Well, you know, there was 12 years difference in our ages. So when she was like a teenager and young. Well, I don't have much memory of that. But when I was in my teens, I remember her as I'm laughing because she always put me on edge a little bit. Like, well, did you do this? Did you have the right clothing? Did you speak loudly? Did you speak correctly? You know, she was always there when you needed her, when I needed her for advice or what to wear or she didn't cook, she didn't bake, but she helped make fudge. I don't know how she did it, but she did a really great fudge. They just inane things, not really important. But one thing I know about her, when I worked for her as a teenager in the beauty parlor, I didn't do hair or anything. I helped her with her products, weighing old and putting things in her little personalized boxes for her powder. And she was very, very strict about everything had to be the right weight, the right size. But she was correct in her business, and I felt it, and I think it was a learning process for me.
When you and your sister were young, how did she react when she knew that something just wasn't right?
Viola never didn't seem to accept if something didn't seem right to her. She didn't accept it. She would investigate. That's probably not the word, but she was. She wanted to appear to be correct, not appear correct. She wanted, if words came out of her mouth, they had to be verified, they had to be her words and her ideas. And she researched most everything that she put forward to the public.
For people who are not aware of what happened in 1946 at the movie theater in New Glasgow, would you mind sharing that? And that turned out to be a seminal moment in Canadian history. And it's important to note that your sister was a very successful businesswoman at the time on her way to Sydney from Halifax. And it seems she certainly wasn't out looking for trouble.
So Viola was, as you said, and is read everywhere, that she was a successful businesswoman. And it had gotten to the point that she was overwhelmed with orders for her products from all over Nova Scotia. So, and she had bought a car, which is an unheard of thing. And this was getting out to the black public population of Nova Scotia. So she got in the car. And of course, my mom, she's very worried about her, but she put a blanket over her knees and gave her a lunch. So that's what people did those days. I guess they didn't have McDonald's and things like that. So Viola got in the car and started her drive. And I think it's a very daunting task to think about. This little woman with the two cushions under her because she was short, so she could reach the in the car. Here she was with her orders all wrapped up and ready to go. getting ready for this long trip to Sydney. So she, when she started, it wasn't a very, you know, bright day, but she determined to get there. She got as far as, in the car, she got as far as New Glasgow, and she heard a noise in the engine, stopped at a garage, and he examined it and said, well, I can't do anything now because I have to order a part, so I won't get it until, you'll have to stay overnight till I get the part for the car. So she said, well, not to worry, I'll be fine. So she walked down the main street in New Glasgow, and she thought, well, she saw this theater, and the marquee said Olivia de Havilland was starring in this movie, The Dark Mirror, and Viola always loved Olivia de Havilland as an actress. She didn't have much time for movies. I think the last time she'd been to a movie was the Gone with the Wind, that was in 1939. So she went in the foyer where the ticket seller was there, the cashier, and she said to her, I would like to have one ticket down, please. The cashier looked at her and said, and handed her a ticket. So Viola took the ticket and went in on the foyer on the lower level of the theater and sat down. Well, she was just getting relaxed and watching the movie when the usher came up and said to her, you miss, you'll have to move, you can't sit here. Viola says, well, why can't I? Well, you have the wrong ticket. Your ticket is for the balcony. You have to get a ticket for the balcony. Viola went back to the ticket, the cashier, and said to her, well, I'd like the ticket for the foyer, for the downstairs. And the ticket seller looked at her and said, well, we're not allowed to sell tickets to you people. Viola paused a minute, and then it dawned on her what the girl meant. So she said, well, when I'm in Halifax, I never sit up in the balcony. I always sit downstairs. I'm more comfortable. So I'm going to sit. So here's the money for the difference of the price between the downstairs level and the balcony. So she just walked back to her seat and sat down. The usher came back and said to her, Miss, you'll have to move. You're not allowed to sit here. Viola said, I offered to pay the difference in the price from upstairs and downstairs, the balcony and the lower level, and I'm sitting here. Well, she came back. She said, I'll have to call a manager. Viola said, well, call the manager. And everybody always asks me at this point, what would you have done? Well, I'm not confrontational. I would have been angry, but I would have just gotten up and walked out with my head down. Viola chose not to walk out. She chose to sit down there. So the manager came and said, you were told you can't sit here. You'll have to move. Viola said, no, I'm sitting here. I offered the difference in the price. And there it is with the cashier, so I'm not moving. He said, well, I'm going to have to get a policeman. Well, Viola said, well, get a policeman. So this little 4 foot, 10 and a half person, 90 pounds, this was her, but this was what I'm trying to describe to you, the scene. As Viola was sitting there, he went out, the manager went out, and he came back with a policeman. And they asked her one more time, are you going to move? Viola said, no. So the policeman took one arm, and the manager, Mr. McNeil, took her other arm and dragged her out of the theater. Dragging her out, she lost her purse and her shoe. One of the patrons there of the movie came over and offered it to her. Viola came out of the theater with the two of them. She came with the policeman in a taxi to the jail. The manager went to get an order for her arrest, and she was put in jail where she stayed overnight. I have asked her, I said, Viola, what did you do all that time overnight? It got dark and you were in jail. To me, all I could hear was the word jail. I mean, I thought that was terrible. So She said, well, you know, she said, I went in and I looked at the surroundings. I sit down on this looked like a grayish cot or something in the corner. And I said, did you lay down? Oh, no, she said, I would lay down there. No, I sat up with my back against the wall. I said, what did you do all that time? She said, well, I realized I had some time to myself. I took my purse and sort of dumped all the stuff out on the cot, and I sorted the stuff and old stuff I didn't need. I came across my appointment book, so I sat up and checked on my appointments and who was coming and who was due and things like that. Before I knew it, she said, it was time, it was daylight, and the matron came to take me, and the policeman and the matron came to take me to the courthouse. When I got to the courthouse, Mr. McNeil was there, the manager of the theater, the usher was there, and the ticket seller was there. And you know, it's so funny, she said, because I said to myself, she said, I didn't do anything wrong, so I'm going to be okay. So every time the judge would say something, did you? And she would say, yes, but. Well, and the manager would say something, and the judge would say, well, did this happen, or did you say? And Viola would say, well, yes, but she never got beyond but before the judge found her guilty of trying to defraud the government, the amusement of the difference between the amusement tax price of the balcony and the level, the lower level, so which was a grand sum of 1 cent. So, Viola said, the judge, as I said, found her guilty. She could pay the fine of $20 plus 6 cents tax and expense tax, or go to jail for 30 days. Well, Viola said, I wanted to go to jail. But she said, I have so many people waiting on me, waiting for me, that I had to get back to my business. So I paid the fine against my better judgment, got in my car, turned the car downward to go home. And I think I'd asked her at that time, well, Viola, you had some orders to deliver in Truro and all the way back to Halifax. Did you stop? Well, she said, no, I didn't. I just came home. And I thought, why didn't I ask her at that time? Why did you go home? You could have made some deliveries, but I think my own thought on this time was that even though she was 32 years old, she was a grown woman with a business. She had been humiliated. She had been thrown in jail. She had the worst things happen to a woman, to anybody. So she wanted to tell someone, and who will you want to, where do you want to go when you've been hurt and humiliated and you're tired and you spend the night in jail? I think you want to go home. I think that's why I think, she never said that, but that's why I think she got the car and came straight home to Halifax to her, and went right in her parents' home, our parents' home, and told them the story. Well, when my father heard that story, I mean, he had his hat on and ready to go. I mean, he was going to go back if he had to walk to New Glasgow. He was so enraged. I mean, she was a grown woman. She had her own business, as I keep saying, and she knew who she was. But she had been humiliated. And I think deep down, you know, she just wanted somebody to hear it. Not just anybody, but her parents. So this is what happened to Viola on that day.
How did this affect her later in life? Did you notice anything different about her?
Well, I didn't notice. And that was when I was a teenager. I left Halifax to live in the States when I was 21, almost 22. But that happened when I was 19. I'm thinking now, how did I went in her store on the weekend to to weigh out her beauty products, the powder mostly, and there was another thing I weighed out, but she did, you know, that I can't see to remember much of a change, if there was any. There must have been some sort of an attitude or change, but I have to be truthful and tell you that I did not notice too much. She, one little thing though, she did seem to be more, I don't know how to express it, more driven. She seemed to be more exact in everything. That's not the word I want. But, like, I would be weighing out her products, and she had her own scales. She had them tested to make sure that they were correct. And she would lean over me when I was labeling the little boxes for the powder. And when I was weighing, she would check them. She would have that check to see if it was all right. But she did those things before the incident. Her first graduation was really, really great. She had Reverend Oliver was there as the MC, which turned out just perfect. Her second graduate was, I think they were 12 or 13 students, and you know that they had it in the ballroom at the YWCA, and the mayor was there, and he did the first dance. You know, I never mentioned this. It just came to me. The first dance, the waltz. The mayor came over and took Viola's hand, and they waltzed all around the room like that. But I'm getting away from the subject, I think, because I'm remembering things as I speak with you, and they become more vivid. But you're asking me, did she seem changed? No, not really, no.
Recently, you were involved in a ceremony along with a student from Ontario, and the student came up with the idea that the government should give the money back that Viola paid for the fine because they realized it was wrong. Can you talk about that, please? And what do you think about that idea to have the loan repaid?
Well, I think it was brilliant. And I say to myself, why didn't I think of that? But I'm so glad that we have a young person, a young girl, a young student think about something instead of, you know, being the frivolous thought. This is, as I said, it's a brilliant idea coming from a young person. And that means that, oh, we're doing well in the idea of changing and getting young people on the right track of knowing what discrimination is and knowing how hard they have been working in the past and know what they can do in the future. It's a brilliant idea.
And that money was to go to you, and you came up with an idea of what you should do with that money. What happened? Where did that money eventually go?
Oh, I wanted that to add to a bursary, a scholarship that was being provided at my alma mater at Cape Breton University. And I say that with pride because I didn't get my BA until I was 77. I just threw a little bit of self-appreciation in there. But it's going to a good cause, and it's a one-year thing. It'll be given to a student who's worthy of it, and I think it's wonderful.
And she certainly left her mark. Everyone can see her now on the $10 bill. That must be very exciting for the family.
You know, it was almost surreal, really, because when they told me that Viola was going to be on a $10 bill, I could hardly believe it. I was given the first $10 bill. I was at home at that time, and they gave me the first $10 bill that was off the press, or whatever the expression that they would use. And here I'm looking at this. At my sister, on a $10 bill, on a bill, a Canadian bill, a bill that only the Queen and figureheads and premiers that were on. And I, you know, my first thought was, Oh, how I wish, not Viola, but I wish my mother and father could see this, how proud they would be. I'm tearing up, but thank you for asking that. It was wonderful.
So you wrote a book, Sister to Courage, about your relationship with your sister Viola, and we talked in advance here a few minutes back, and you said you'd be kind enough to read a bit. What did you decide to share with us from your book, Sister to Courage?
This book is, I'm got it open here now. It's okay. This is after 4 happy years, I received a notice from Dalhousie University in 1969 that in 6 months I would have to be leaving. They were going to tear down all the establishments on University Avenue, the accommodations. I received the notice by mail. Well, I'm sorry to go, but in 6 months, surely, I can find something else. That's when the horror stories began. The boys would come home to me and then say, Mom, I saw a sign in the window on South Street, apartment for rent, and I'd go there and it would be gone. And I never thought about being black. I didn't think so. I mean, everybody was white, and the only black in people were the students. And there weren't many black families in the area. A friend from the fisheries where I worked was driving me around. This apartment is for rent. That apartment is for rent. When we'd get there, we'd have the newspaper in our hand and go to the apartment. The apartment listed in the paper. I circled everything I could find, and then they would say it was gone when we got there. Rented already, or else they'd jack up the price. And one man said to me, you people can't pay this kind of rent. Another man said, you married? I said, no, I'm divorced. Divorce? Got children? I have 3 children, yes. Oh, no. No, no. That's too much payment, partying going on. Well, would he assume that if I'd been white, would we? I don't know. I mean, I have 3 kids. I'm alone, and I'm partying? I don't think so. Okay?
You know, here we are 75 years later after that incident in New Glasgow. Do you think Viola would be surprised to know that her story is still very much touching for a lot of people and still resonates, since 1946 when that happened?
I think so. I really do think so. I said that quickly, and then I'm thinking of her, thinking of her and who she was and what she did and what she was. I'm thinking of her as my sister and around the house and what she would do. I think she would be surprised, yes. I had to go over that again to think about what I was saying and my answer. And I think she would be surprised. She'd be very, very happy inside. She never seemed to. I don't mean she didn't show happiness, but I think she would be surprised at where her action has gone and what it has meant to us as a black society, white society too.
And that's quite amazing, being in your 90s, you've never lost focus or energy in shining light on your sister's story. Is there still work to do? How else would you like Viola to be recognized?
I would like to see I don't read Twitter and things like that. I mean, that's it's okay. I'm sure it's fine, but I've been told several things that have been written about Viola and her case, and some of them are definitely wrong. I would like to see that trail sort of cleaned up. I mean, like one person, I was told, one person said that her father was white, and another person said that she, that in the end, this whole thing had crushed her so that she was in her apartment in New York. She was in misery. She was unhappy, like curled up like a little, you know, like, and I've been told those things have been said, and I'd like that, I think I'll try to do something about that myself. And try to I don't mean the people are vicious. They some people get an image after they read about something or an incident. They think that people are they just fade away and curl up somewhere in misery. Viola never wouldn't. I saw her when I was living in the, I lived in the States myself 10 years, and she would come to visit me. She was not a miserable person, you know. She wasn't weighing on the fact of the injustice and how people had been mean, and she got on with her life. That's what I think that I've said all along. That's who she was. She was not a person. If something happened that had to be, that she thought had to be fixed, she reasoned it out. And that's, I think I've got her image across. I hope I have. I'm not saying that she was always up and right and up and ready to go, and that everybody has their ups and downs. But she had the downs, and she said, well, we can fix that, you know. So that's who she was. She came to help me when both of us were living in the States. I was in trouble. And I had John Social Service. She came. Mom wrote her, and she was living in New York. She said, you know, I haven't heard from Wanda for a little while. I wonder what's happening. Could you check on her? She came over. She came over to I was living in Winthrop, Massachusetts, and she came over and fixed it in one day. I mean, I was living in I had been abandoned, and I had no lights and no heat, no anything in my apartment with three little kids. She came over from New York to Winthrop, Massachusetts, and she was here at my place overnight. The next day she was at the town hall in Winthrop, Massachusetts, and she fixed it just like that. Because what am I trying to say? I'm trying to give you the image of this person that she... That she wasn't sitting down and moaning and groaning at what happened. What had to be done, she fixed it.
Constable Mike Carter of the RCMP says he understands why some people may be a bit concerned if they're dealing with a real police officer after the shooting rampage last year where a gunman had a fake police car and a fake uniform. He'll explain how to handle that if you're worried during a traffic stop, and he'll also talk about what some drivers should do to make the roads safer for everyone.
RCMP Traffic Services in Nova Scotia, we are responsible for road safety for commercial vehicles, for private citizens who use the roads and highways throughout the entire province. We approach it from an analytical point. We look at it from an educational perspective and an enforcement perspective to ensure road safety.
Is social media helpful to you guys to get the word out when you're looking for information on investigations?
It does. Social media plays a big role, more for us to push out our messaging. When it comes to, for example, we are currently in Distracted Driving Awareness Month, so our enforcement strategies for February focus on cell phone users and distributors. We'll push social media out to broadcast that to the public to say, hey, mind yourself on the roads, and make sure you're not being distracted while you drive. So we'll push out, like I said, at the beginning of every month, the road safety calendar, and that's a provincial mandate. So we look at it and we kind of coordinate our activities and resources to make a concerted effort into combating distracted driving.
So the Mounties Awareness Campaign for February is about distracted driving. What is it that you want people to understand about being behind the wheel while using a handheld device?
We're looking for road users to reduce using cell phones. Is basically the short of it all. But we focus. We do different tactics. We have it's called a spotter project, where we have an officer parked up the street in an unmarked or not a police vehicle, and then he's calling out down the road. When he sees somebody come by with a cell phone, he calls the waiting officers down the road, who will then pull out in marked uniform or marked police cars and intercept those vehicles and write the tickets off of the evidence that's collected by the first officer.
Is social media a bit of a double-edged sword sometimes in police work? Just one example of that. There have been times when people driving in the Sydney River area, they say they would notice the police on an overpass on the 125 bypass near Sydney River, Balls Creek area. And then someone will write on Facebook, hey, watch out for the police. They're on Highway 125 on the overpass. Keep your eyes peeled. And it's interesting, the argument. Some people say, let the police do their job. Don't write anything on the internet yet. Others say, hey, thank you for the heads up.
No, absolutely. We're fully aware of the different cop watch groups or accountability or advisory groups that are out there that have members that are watching for policing activities in certain areas. From a personal perspective, being an RCMP officer, having my location reported starts to create a safety hazard for me, because let's say there is a person out there who wants to cause harm to police, they now know where I am. But that's very, very minimal. The impact it may have is that, so if the group has 100 followers and maybe 20 of them are paying attention on the Facebook group at that time, then we may see a few people avoid us, but really, we watch those websites as well, and if we get to a spot where we want to move on, we'll just pick up and move to the next location and carry on.
About the roundabouts, they are popping up all over the place in Cape Breton, including one in Waikagama, and there are two more coming to the Sydney River area. Are they paying off? Are people getting used to them? There must be a learning curve when you're used to driving a certain way for so long.
Yes, absolutely. I think there is a significant learning curve. It's a different concept to many drivers who don't often venture outside of their municipalities or their towns. Many of the on-ramps and off-ramps now in our area are roundabout type, so they that would lead to some, say, confusion on the drivers, an unawareness of the surroundings, and they add that new tuck plus the driving, and maybe they're just getting a little bit non-confident in their abilities to navigate these. So a common tactic that we see with those drivers is that they'll slow down. So they'll go really slow through the roundabout, and it will impede other traffic and may frustrate other traffic, but at least they're getting through it for the most part safely without causing collisions. But once they go through it two or three times, then they've figured out the concept and are able to navigate it in the future.
And this time of year, sometimes you hear about or see people driving around with snow-covered vehicles. Is that a problem for traffic services?
Actually, that's a reoccurring issue that we encounter every year. And it's clearing the snow off of their windshield. Sometimes they'll just use a hand and just make enough of an eye hole that they can look out and peer out. Other times they'll clear the windshield, but then they won't clear the roof off, which creates a totally different issue. But at the beginning of every winter season, we inevitably will charge multiple drivers with failing to clear or driving with an obstructed windshield. So they'll leave the snow on it, or they won't let the heaters warm up or clear the frost off the outside of the windows. With the problem with snow on the roof is that once it starts to melt, when you go to brake at an intersection, now that snow load will slide to the front window, potentially causing your visibility to be reduced to zero again. So there's some serious safety hazards, and the tactic, I guess, of people that just jump on the highway and believe that clearing the snow means driving at 100 kilometers an hour will clear the snow. Well, that's now creating a visibility hazard or a potential ice debris hazard for drivers behind you, depending on the type of moisture on your roof of your car.
And a following motorist, a motorist behind someone with snow and ice on their vehicle, they may not clue in immediately that there's a potential hazard in front of them with, you know, a half a foot of snow on the top of their vehicle.
Oh, correct. And I know a lot of the trucking companies as well, because of the high box transport trucks, they'll have special like brushes that they'll drive through that will help clear that load off of the top of vehicles. And it's quite dangerous when, and I'm sure many people have seen this, where sheets of ice will come off and they'll go through windshields, because at that speed, ice is like rock, right? Like it'll take windshields out, cause some serious harm to people and potentially fatalities. So it is vitally important for motorists to invest in the $5 snow brush, make sure you got scrapers, and make sure the inside and outside windows of your vehicle are frost-free.
People were overwhelmed with the tragedy in Port Pique last year, and someone was using a police cruiser. More recently, the police say they arrested an Antigonish man for impersonating the police, and he was using a mock police car. What do you think about people who may be nervous now and question whether or not they're being approached by the police during a traffic stop or by someone else with more sinister intentions?
There's certainly an increased awareness of the public is what I think we're seeing. In a couple of occasions here, I've been asked, stopped by motorists. I've been just parked roadside, and they've come up and approached me with some legitimate questions about their safety. What do I do if I'm going to be stopped by a police car? If I'm a single female, I'm driving down the road, how do I know it's a police car or that the police are trying to stop me? It is an offense not to stop for a police officer, but it is also an offense for people to impersonate police officers as well. One of the tactics that we've been telling people to do is that request identification. If you do stop and you're feeling uncomfortable about the situation, then by all means, it's the public's right to ask for that officer to show them identification. We all carry a badge. We all carry an RCMP identification card. Ask those. If you see a police officer and you've never seen a real badge before, ask to see it. I've shown my badge to many people just so that they know what my badge looks like compared to not knowing one, the one that you get out of a like a Kellogg's box. But that's one technique. If things seem hinky or unusual, then have call 911. If you don't think you're being stopped by a legitimate police officer, call 911 or call your local police line. That dispatcher at the other end will be able to tell you if the person that the officer that has stopped you is providing a name that is one of our police officers. And quite frequently in our marked police cars, we have GPS locating so that we can tell, that dispatcher can tell the public or tell that person that's calling in to say, yes, that is a police officer. He works for us. This is his name or her name. So that's another tactic. But just running from the police is not generally a recommended activity.
Do you know if there's any discussion among the police? You know, drivers out there, they may be a little bit on edge when they're pulled over because of those incidents, people impersonating police. And the police should be patient with drivers if they seem a bit standoffish during a traffic stop.
I've possibly some internal messaging. I've read one or two just short briefs on how to how to talk to the public about it. Basically, the call in the 911 asking for the identity of the police officer. We're aware of it, but to be completely honest, I have yet to have anybody that I've stopped in a motor vehicle infraction question that I'm a police officer stopping them. So I don't know if it's their comfort level that everything around them makes sense, and I am wearing a full uniform. I'm driving in a police car, but I haven't had that direct engagement yet with somebody that's hesitant or unsure of me being a police officer.
Can you wrap up with any tips to pass along to the listeners about safe driving in the wintertime?
Well, for winter driving, it's very critical for drivers traveling anywhere in the province to just to plan ahead. Check the weather, both at your departing location and where you're going to, because quite often in this province, as you're well aware, that the weather could be totally different in two different spots. we'd recommend that you have a crash bag or a kit bag that has blankets and candles and things like that, that you can, if you do get off the road and stuck in weather, that you have a means to self-rescue yourself, basically. We're looking at just motorists to use their common sense and slow down a little bit with the unpredictability of roads. The Department of Transportation does a fantastic job at keeping our roads ice and snow clear. But during those snow events, there are times where they can't keep up with it. So just slow down a little bit. Give yourself more time to react to situations that may develop. If it doesn't feel like it's safe to pass, then don't pass. We'll get to where we're going in time. So we're asking people just not to rush. Keeping your distance between vehicles on slippery roads, of course, it takes a lot longer to stop your vehicle. So give yourself enough stopping space. Keeping pace with the traffic around you at a safe speed. Being prepared, having winter tires. There's a lot of people that believe all season tires are a winter tire. Those are really just a three season tire. So what we recommend is that you talk to a local tire supply company and get quality winter tires for your vehicle and have them swapped out. Carrying a winter emergency kit, bottled water, like I said, blankets, things like that. And just stay calm and stay focused. Be prepared to react to any situation that may pop up in front of you.
Coyotes are especially busy this time of year. It's mating season, so they're hungry. They're looking for a partner, too. The Department of Natural Resources says it's a good time to pay even more attention to your pets. Mike Boudreau is a conflict wildlife biologist for the DNR.
Well, mating season it's a broad range of time, usually January and February. So they're fairly active, defending territories against each other and looking for mates. At the same time, food is more scarce. Wintertime, it's colder. The snow covers up mice, fruit, apples, that kind of thing, if there's any left under wild trees. So they're moving around a bit more. The cold weather, they're moving. They're looking for food. And they're also more visible this time of the year because of the snow, the white background. You know, without the snow, they blend in fairly well, so you probably drive by them and not see them. They're found all across the province, but that doesn't mean that they're in every community across the province, if I could put it that way. If you don't hear them and you don't see them, then there's probably not much or a lot lower risk. It doesn't mean they're not there, it's just that you're not seeing them or hearing them. But when you do, you should, when you have a cat or dog, not let them outside. Don't feed them outside. Don't let them run, i.e. don't open the door up to let the dog go do his business and then an hour later come back and let them in. You should be with them. Try not to feed them outside. Don't leave out food. Some people put food out on the back deck or give them a bone in the backyard to play with and they leave it there. Those are potential food items or smells that would bring them around. You know, there have been reports where dogs and cats have been attacked, especially the small ones. They could be considered as prey if things like snowshoe hare and mice and rodents are few and far between. So it's, you know, take care of your pet. When you go out at night, make sure you're with them when they have the lighted backyard. Recently there was a report on the news where one pet owner would go out and make noise before they let the dog out for a pee. That's a good idea, just to let other animals know that you're coming out in the yard.
Do you think they study us in a way in how we take care of our pets and they learn to hide back and stand off while they're watching us with our pets, waiting for us to make a mistake, especially this time of year? And an example of that being if they are close enough to your home and they hear a door open, they are expecting to hear a small animal exit the home and venture out into the backyard.
I think that they respond to stimulus very well, just like a dog does. They learn when they're going through your yard, they know when we're out and when we're not, and most of them are going through, I shouldn't say, if they are going through yards, they know when we're out and when we're not. So they typically will run through someone's backyard if that's the travel route they're taking when no one else is there. I do think that they're astute enough to know when there are opportunities. So if every night you put the dog out at 7:30 and you leave the dog out in the yard, they'll soon figure out as they're traveling through that animal is out there, likely from the barking and or the noise it's making in the yard or the scent that it's leaving when it goes to the bathroom, that kind of thing, right?
Can you talk about their ability to be in sync with one another when they're hunting and their ability to work as a team?
They certainly hunt in groups. They can hunt alone, too. We've done some research on tracking coyotes throughout the winter because it's easier to track them in the snow. And again, you will get them in single animals and or larger groups, family groups. They move through the landscape. There was a video that was posted on the news about three coyotes in someone's backyard in Hammond's Plains. And you could, when you're watching the video, you could see them move through the wooded section as one unit. So those that get very good at doing that, it works well for them.
Are they able to draw their prey in to give whatever it is they're hunting, to give it the impression that the coyote is actually being chased by a dog, for example, only to trick the dog, and they lead that dog back into the woods, and there the dog runs into a group or a band of coyotes?
Yeah, I've had reports of that the coyote lured them into the woods and the dog didn't come home after that. I'm not so sure that that's a reality. I don't know if they can think that way is what I'm thinking. If you know, you're suggesting that the coyote can toy with the dog and draw them in so that the other ones that are hiding in the sidelines are there waiting for it. I'm not sure that that's how we would perceive it, I guess, or potentially perceive it, though I'm not sure that that's how they're perceiving it.
A young woman died as a result of a coyote attack in the Highlands back in 2009, and a boy was attacked a few years ago in Westmount. Luckily, he survived. That was back in 2014. And when we hear about things like this, has it changed the way people go hiking or changed their habits in any way?
I think, you know, we've certainly provided a lot of good information to people since then. And I do think that people are, you know, they're taking a walking sticks now, or they're walking in groups. They're being more aware of their surroundings. So I do think that there's kind of been a change in attitude of hikers.
What do you think about claims of people seeing a coyote and a wolf mix? Is that possible?
It's there's been some work in our lab and others, not just in Nova Scotia, that have confirmed that there is a genetic mix, but it's not something that you're going to look at the animal and say, well, that's definitely a mix. Ours are bigger in the east than they are in the west. Their physical appearance is different, but they're also smaller. On average, they're smaller, I guess is what I would say.
And yes, can you talk about that, the difference between the eastern and western coyote?
The fur is a lot lighter in the west, a little silkier. Ours are coarser and darker. As far as the phenotype of them, like the coloration of them, they are a little smaller. We tend to get a larger animal out here. The average sizes aren't that much different, I don't think. But we tend to get animals in the 50-pound range.
They often get a bad rap, but they are very interesting animals. Are you able to personally handle them on occasion?
I do, yeah. I've been, I worked with a project that we radio collared them back in the 90s. And as a result of having collars, was able to get very close to them. I mean, even for myself, you have to show a lot of respect for them. They are wild animals, and you certainly don't want to get any closer than need be. But in these cases, we had to physically handle them to put collars on them and then let them go.
It's an interesting point that some people make. They say coyotes are too much of a nuisance, especially this time of year. They say, but it's actually us who's invading them with things like clear cutting and other activities that can put stress on animals in the forest.
There's two trains of thought on that. One is that you go in and level out a piece of ground and build a subdivision or community, and you displace those animals. And there's probably some of that. I do think it happens a little bit. But I think the flip to that is when you do that, you also create a better habitat, which invites more prey species. You end up with more raccoons in the subdivision than you would in the back 40. And that's because there's more food, there's more cover, there's less predators. You end up with things like deer moving in because people plant gardens and landscape around the yards. There tends to be green spaces that allows wildlife to use as a corridor. So you end up with things like deer and bear and coyotes moving into neighborhoods through these corridors at a much higher number than I think that were displaced when you actually develop the land.
And of course, people talk about hearing them howl at night. Do you guys get a lot of reportings of sightings in the daytime?
I think they're just as active. They can be just as active in the day. There is some research out there that suggests that in areas that when you look at a park, they can be more active in the park than they could be out in the community because there's more negative association out in the community than there is in a protected area or a park kind of thing. So they're changing their behavior, i.e. either in and around an urban area or community, they're more active in twilight, dusk, dark than they are during the day because we're more active in the day.
Do coyotes in Nova Scotia carry rabies or any other diseases?
They are a rabies vector, although we do not have rabies in Nova Scotia. Now, having said that, we have had bat rabies. We haven't had raccoon rabies, which is something that the coyotes would and could carry. They do have parasites that could be problematic to pets and people, but we haven't found many in Nova Scotia.
If someone's out for a walk in or near the woods and they find themselves in a bit of a standoff with a coyote and the coyote isn't backing down, what's the best thing to do?
I think if you were walking down a trail and had one come out and stop to look at you, then you'd want to make a lot of noise, make yourself look big, and slowly back away. You definitely don't want to approach it. Talk out loud. If you're by yourself, have your walking stick or pick up a stick and just move out. It could be just very curious that you're there. It could be a very chance meeting as it come out on the road. But you don't want to take that risk. So leave the area is what I would say.
That's all for Dialogue this week on the Coast 89.7. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.